Please be seated.
The final case for today is case number 51270, Patrick Madsen v. State. Ms. Malone.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Malone from the State Public Defender's Office. I'm here on behalf of Patrick Madsen. I guess I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for... Okay, thank you. Patrick Madsen is a 24-year-old young man appealing his convictions for two sexual assaults and two lewdnesses with a child. He's been sentenced to a total of 4 life sentences. He will be eligible for parole in 40 years. He was 22 when the events at issue took place. And with due respect to the severity of these charges and these crimes, I want to emphasize his youthfulness and the severity of the sentences as well in the face of a trial that is so ripe with error. In May of 2006, Patrick was staying in Alamo, New Mexico, on the living room couch of his friend, the victim's stepfather. Because the adults all worked in Las Vegas, had to leave early in the morning about 4:30, they generally would be in bed in their separate rooms, the parents, by 9 p.m. The girl, age 13 at the time, was allowed to stay up and watch TV until 10 or 11. In late May or June, two incidents occurred. The girl and Patrick were on the couch watching TV. Patrick was drinking vodka, perhaps getting drunk. According to the girl's testimony, Patrick then force-fed her some vodka with a straw, talked to her about how he trusted her, gave her a hug, then testified that he removed her shorts, licked her vagina, got on top of her, and penetrated her with his penis. Second incident occurred the next night on the couch again. The girl said Patrick took off her shirt, kissed and fondled her breasts, removed her shorts, and penetrated her a second time. And the jury convicted Mr. Madsen of 2 counts of sexual assault and 2 counts of lewdness with a child. This brings us to the first problem, which is whether Mr. Madsen was even properly on trial for all 4 counts, or whether he should only have been on trial for 2 counts of sexual assault and 1 count of lewdness. The criminal complaint certainly charged all 4, but after the preliminary hearing, the Justice of the Peace specifically said he was bound over on 2 counts of sexual assault and 1 count of lewdness.
And Ms. Malone, that should be a pretty easy issue, but when we look at the record, it doesn't look like the defense raised this issue in district court at any time. It was phrased, matter of fact, first time on appeal.
That seems to be sort of true. Apparently nobody recognized this discrepancy. And there is certainly a problem in the record. I mean, you know, portions of it suggest that it could have been an inadvertent clerical error.
Did the same attorney handle the preliminary hearing that handled the district court proceedings?
Yes, I believe so. Could be, but on the other hand, it also could have been a lack of evidence. We just don't know. And our position would be that regardless of the state of the record, this court cannot presume a clerical error in a situation like this. There's no specific guiding law on this kind of situation, not surprisingly.
It can't be raised first time on appeal. That's my concern, you know.
Well, but I think when we're talking about something as sort of fundamental as this kind of error, again, we're looking at a sort of a plain error, constitutional error analysis.
Would you say that it's structural error?
Yeah. I mean, I think so, absolutely, if you're going to say that he shouldn't have been on trial for this in the first place. Certainly the court has recognized in the pretrial context in COSA that it violates basic principles of fundamental fairness to an accused to make a presumption that there's a clerical error, especially when that presumption ends up sending Mr. Madsen to prison for life. We get this then to the second set of errors, which sort of compound this whole problem, which is the problem of the redundancy of the sexual assault and the lewdness convictions, and the question over what conduct might have been one versus what conduct was simply an initiation of a sexual assault. And a motion to dismiss on this issue was filed, was not decided until the settling of jury instructions, but this issue was indeed raised. The argument being that the the preliminary licking of her vagina or fondling her breasts was not a separate and independent act of lewdness, but was simply an initiation into the overall assaults. And I think the victim's testimony reflects her perception that that was how it proceeded. She testifies regarding a sequence of events, like this court discussed in the Cowley case. Simply one element of a continuous assault. For example, the victim denied that Mr. Madsen stopped or that he got up or paused or changed anything. She said, no, he stayed on top of me. He lay on me and then took off his pants. I mean, obviously he had to use his hands to take off his pants, but that's not the same thing as, for example, in the Townsend case where there's this idea that he stops, maybe has time for reflection, and then goes back to commit.
Ms. Wall, my only concern is this, is if the judge instructed the jury on both lewdness and sexual assault, that's argued to the jury. You have to establish each offense beyond a reasonable doubt. The state has to.
Right.
So isn't it really a jury call if there were separate acts here taking place?
Certainly it can be a jury call. I would also submit, however, that based on this record, the state did not prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. And it is their burden, as you point out. Two separate and distinct mutually exclusive acts. Based on the victim's testimony, it's just a series of continuous acts. Now, when you start getting into the third problem that further compounds all this, which is the testimony of the same Officer Cowley, who we had in the previous Thede cases, same problem there. Pages of hearsay testimony. Again, no objection, and understand that, but such egregious plain error that it infects the whole trial and really screws up the reliability of the findings. For example, you know, Ms. Cowley made these sort of suggestions, and then she told me that he stopped. And then she said he stood up and, you know, did something. Clearly sort of trying to place on the record this idea of two phases and two separate, you know, acts of conduct. I would dispute what I guess the state is going to get up and say, which is that this fits perfectly within section NRS 51035-2B, which is the declarant is available at trial, subject to cross-examination, and the testimony is consistent but offered to rebut an allegation of recent fabrication. I think the case law will reflect that concept of a recent fabrication is not simply that the defense is trying to defend itself, you know, is put on a defense and cross-examine the witness and say, well, I'm going to test your credibility here. It's an actual allegation of fabrication. None of that happened here. In fact, Officer Cowley's testimony is essentially totally consistent with the victim's. And is nothing more than continually reinforcing, as Mr. Logan was saying, reinforcing, bolstering, vouching, stating again the same thing that initially comes just from one place, from the victim, who could have been cross-examined, and indeed was, on all of those potential issues. So it's our position that was absolutely inadmissible, clouds the whole trial even further with respect to all these same issues that are piling onto themselves. That is going to end up including the admission of prior bad acts, which I believe the brief sets out in a lot of detail, lack of a Petrocelli hearing, and those kinds of issues.
Can we talk about that for a minute, the Petrocelli issue? Now, we're concerned about the statement. I guess it was the victim's mother testified about the defendant had another underage girlfriend. And there was, from what I understand from the record, there was no Petrocelli hearing on that. I don't know if she blurted it out or...
She sort of blurted it out.
Okay, so the state probably didn't know it was coming.
It was not specifically elicited, no, but she did sort of say it several times.
Okay, now my understanding from the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the defense objected to this testimony and asked to strike it, and the judge overruled it and said it was relevant to him... attraction to younger girls or something like that?
I don't remember specifically the language or, yes, I believe there was an objection. There were a couple of objections where the judge simply said, well, you know, overruled, it doesn't matter, she's already said it. I can't remember specifically if that was one of them or if he said it's actually relevant to these issues. I'm sorry, I would have to check the transcript.
My understanding from the record is he said it was relevant. You know that.
Okay.
System.
Okay.
So I'm just
I would disagree.
Well, I, obviously, but I just want to get the procedural history how it got there. Is the Petrocelli hearing? Perhaps would you say the state, if the state didn't know it was coming, how could they do a Petrocelli hearing?
I would expect the state was on notice. There's a potential for that to come in, and would just. You know.
We'll hear from the state. I'm sure they'll have some response to that.
Mr. Barlow, for the state of Nevada.
Once again, thank you. Gregory Barlow, Lincoln County District Attorney for respondent, state of Nevada. Let me first touch on a couple of points made by my opposing counsel. The record is very complete. There were four counts charged at a preliminary hearing set in this matter. Evidence was presented on all four counts. I have no explanation why the Justice of the Peace, in her binding order, only cited the two assaults and one lewdness. All four counts were alleged in the information and were presented to the defendant and to the court. There was no writ filed pre-trial in this matter, nor was objection made at time of trial, post-evidence, or pre-evidence. It on its face would seem to pose an interesting dilemma. And in fact, at least the first three citations in the appellant's brief go to this issue. But I think we're fortunate in this state. The law has been over 40 years made in this, and that's the Asbo case coming out of Clark County in 1968. The right to a preliminary hearing is not a constitutional right. It's a statutory right. It's there solely to protect defendants from unsubstantiated charges, casual charges, vendetta, that sort of thing, to where the state is required to come in and at least show a basic showing, which, as we know, the standard is a minimal standard of commission or event of a crime and the probability or likelihood that the person charged committed it. Once that's established, there's really no defense. There's no nothing. It goes over. In this case, all four were charged as the defense was on notice. I mean, they had gone through prelim with this. They had everything. They knew what was going on, and it was charged. And obviously, the standard at trial is beyond a reasonable doubt. It's the higher standard. And having raised no writ, having raised no objection, it is the state's position that they had waived any defect or any challenge, that there was no preliminary hearing. Now, having said that, that takes care of some of it. They then attempt to bootstrap this in their brief by alleging that, well, there was uncharged conduct admitted in evidence, i.e., the evidence of the one charge that was not in the bindover order. The charge was in the information. It was there. It was properly before the court. And I think that argument fails. I think if you find that preliminary hearing is not a constitutional right, having been no objection, you then can find no plain error in that issue. And I also want to point out, counsel for appellant was seeming to argue that because this defendant received these sentences, this court should take notice and base a decision on that. And that's really just not the way it should be. I mean, I understand error at trial. I understand error in law, error in fact. But as we point out to the juries at trial, you are not to consider the sentence. That's not your problem. And I don't believe that's a problem here for this court. That's not what's being done. Now, in the other area where counsel argues, and I think it was probably brought out, that this is really a jury call. The evidence is relevant, the evidence is admissible, and it's a jury way. That's what we have them for. And the defendant was distinct in his acts. And I know there have been other cases, unfortunately, or fortunately, I argued a case in this court many years ago on this particular issue when I was with the public defender's office, and we had a gentleman on a sexual assault who had performed various assaults on the woman in question before he was through with her. And one of my main arguments was, well, this is all just one event. And the court was distinct to point out that separate assaults, separate manners of assault become separate offenses. And you just don't get one and get to do everything you want. And that's what's been argued here, not the case. The defendant paused and stopped. He acted in lewd manner with a child victim and then had to stop and disrobe himself to proceed further. And that's what he did. There were distinct acts, distinct in time, distinct in action. It's not as though he removed his clothes and went back to the lewdness actions of licking her vagina. But he went on to penetrate into assault. Because of that, because I think that the evidence is clear here that he committed the acts, the jury acted, they considered, they had before them the evidence, and they rendered a verdict. The verdict.
Mr. Farrell, do we need to be concerned with respect to the testimony of the mother regarding the other underage girlfriend?
You know, as a prosecutor, you always wish you could wipe out the 18 minutes of tape. I did not solicit it. I wasn't looking for it. I don't think it rises to this point in the fact that she had an underage girlfriend. The court considered in hearing the objection and ruled that it would pertain to his attractiveness or attraction to young girls.
Or propensity.
Sounds like Petrocelli type. If he's going to do that, he would have to make a complete Petrocelli analysis. Wouldn't you agree?
Quite possibly.
So quite you're arguing it's just, if it's error, it's harmless?
I think given the magnitude of the evidence in the case, I did not seek to bring it out. It was not part of my strategy to bring that out. It came out. You sit and suck wind briefly when that happens, but it happens. I think the court dealt with it, and I've not heard in the other than counsel's and in their statements and their briefs how the court was wrong. So I don't know other than that how to answer that, Justice Gibbons. It's what it is.
Well, it's wrong if it requires a Petrocelli hearing and you have to go through the three prongs, including the probative value versus the prejudice, you know, like that. I think he just said it was relevant, and you have to show it by clear and convincing evidence. That wasn't done, that analysis. So there's a problem there, Mr. Marlowe. My concern is if it's harmless, though, in the whole scheme. And you're saying there's so much evidence.
I don't think it rises to a level that would require the case to hinge on that. And again, the court, had we known ahead of time that, you know, this was going to happen, that certainly I think I would have, I know I would have asked for the Petrocelli hearing, said, Judge, we got an evidence question here, this witness is going to say this, because she has this knowledge, you know, can we do this?
I think we would have been more comfortable if it had been stricken by the trial judge and maybe a curative instruction. Then I think the harmless error is definitely a possibility. This is a little more difficult.
Yeah, it's different than our other two where it was denied.
And anybody who's been in a public defender's office like Ms. Malone and yourself knows that this can result in a mistrial many times over the years that I practiced.
If it rises to that level,
yeah,
and can do. I don't think it does in this case, and I don't think it controls the case. Any other questions?
Anything further, Justice Gibbons or Justice Sater? Mr. Barlow, thank you. Ms. Malone, you have 4 minutes and 17 seconds in rebuttal. And you might as well start with this. Is this harmless error that we're talking about by not having the Petrocelli and by having somebody blurt out something that the district attorney really wasn't looking for?
No, it's not harmless. I mean, I think I take issue with this characteristic that there's this overwhelming evidence in this trial. It's essentially he said, she said. You know, there's no physical evidence introduced. There are no other witnesses. There are no medical exams introduced, at least at trial. You know, those kinds of things, that evidence might have been out there, but it did not come in. It was not presented to the jury. The case hinges on whether you believe her or him, or although he didn't testify. But so I would say, yes, absolutely, for the mother to suggest that somehow he has a predilection for young girls is, you know, very prejudicial. And certainly should have been addressed more completely than it was. Moreover, I would also just add that even if the court finds that he was properly charged on all four counts, I would submit that the remaining errors, which just continually confound and occlude the whole trial proceeding, and the argument that the lewdness essentially merges in with the sexual assaults, that would take care of those issues and render the lewdness issues, the lewdness counts, reversible. And finally, with respect to Officer Cowley, I mean, it would be perfectly proper for her to testify. I conducted an examination. I, you know, talked to the girl, and on the basis of what she told me, I went and talked to so-and-so else. I talked to the forensic lab. I collected some evidence, and I did this and that. But to stand there and say, she told me he did this, and then she told me he said that, and then she told me that he said that he had said this to somebody else, and this sort of constant repetition of what the declarant had said.
I can't remember again, Ms. Mullen, we got all the three cases today. Was that objected to?
No. Again, not objected to. I mean, every once in a while there was an objection, but nothing overall. So, and on that I would just submit it.
Any questions, Justice Gibbons or Justice Sato, for Ms. Malone? Thank you, Ms. Malone. Thank you, Mr. Barlow. Thanks to all of you. And this case will stand submitted and will be in recess until tomorrow.